Welcome to the Delix Pod with me, James Bainford. I know I always say I'm excited about this week's guest, but I really am. Dr. David Cartland is someone that there should be lots more of, but there aren't. And that's basically a GP who's seen the light, who's called out the bullshit, suffered consequences. But, I mean, Dave, I think you'll agree, the truth is the most important thing, regardless of...
Yeah, absolutely. And do you know what? The first thing, it's not that difficult to see it either. I keep saying to people, I'm not delving deeply into a lot of things here. It's just basic ethics, basic science, basic statistics without going very far into it. So, you know, these people at the moment in my profession can't see the wood for the trees, that's for sure.
Well, okay. So tell me first of all, your background. I read a bit of it. I know you've got a first class honours degree.
So I did. That's where my background's slightly different from most medics that do a 5-year degree. So I went to university for a hell of a long time. I went for 10 years. So I did a biomedical science degree with quite a weighting of immunology, virology, and microbiology. And following that, as I got first class, as you said, first class honours degree, went on to do a master's where I published some scientific literature in the world of cardiovascular angiogenesis. So, you know, I've got experience of publishing work as well and statistics and the methods around that, and then went on to do a graduate program medicine degree, of which that was a 4-year program. And so, yeah, lots of experience in terms of the training side of it, 10 years. And then I qualified as a doctor in 2008. And so I've been a doctor for, I'm 40 this weekend, so I'm not very good at maths, but 2008, so 14, 15 years experience postgraduate.
That's long enough for you to impress me that you've...
Well, you kind of have to justify your position, James, in the conversation these days, even in the coffee room, you know, that you've got the credentials to be able to be given 30 seconds of their time.
Yeah, well, exactly. And I would imagine that you've gone on a similar journey to the one I've gone on, and it's what Ola Damagod describes as the heroic journey, and it's the journey from ignorance to awareness, and it's very hard won, this process, because once you see the truth, you are made to suffer for it, and you see the world as a much uglier, darker place than perhaps you were brought up to believe. But at the same time, you know so much more about how things really are.
Yeah, and just to say at this point, really, just so your viewers can see that I'm an anti-vaxxer. That's what my name is these days down in Cornwall. But actually, I've had the vaccine, so that's a USP to my story, really, that actually I was duped myself into taking the vaccine, which we can talk about.
I've got to ask if you want actually, to. Question one.
Yeah.
Have you, your wife's had it as well, I think. Have you, either of you had any vaccine side effects?
Well, the story goes, I took the first one because my friend had died of apparent COVID, and there was a lot more to the story than meets the eye, to keep it brief. You know, she had pretty much a manhandling in ITU, lots of consequences of being intubated and de-intubated, etc. So I took my vaccine because of that. My best friend in this world, almost sister, passed away from what I felt at the time, or was told at the time, was COVID. So I took it as a knee jerk. And then the second jab I took because tap on the shoulder came and said, look, you know, your job's going to be under scrutiny if you're not fully vaccinated. And that was kind of the point where I just started to think, oh, that's a bit strange, you know, when have we ever coerced anyone into a medical treatment? But yeah, in terms of the first vaccine, I was in bed for 3 days afterwards. Headaches, electric shock zaps, I kind of called them brain zaps. Headaches, like I don't get headaches really, I just get headaches, and that was it really. It was just severe headaches, really put me down for 3 days. Second vaccine, not so much. You know, didn't even feel the needle go in, and I didn't have any headaches at all. Absolutely fine. Didn't even have a low-grade fever, sore arm. So that second vaccine passed without much in the way of problems. My wife had the second one at the same time, and she's had, I won't disclose her medical problems, but yeah, she's had some issues, consequence of that, mild issues. But, you know, we were lucky, I think, because I speak to a lot of vaccine injured people now, and there's some absolute horror stories.
We can talk about those in a bit. I just want to talk here about your story first, because that is interesting that you spent 3 days in bed after a jab. Now, I've had lots and lots of jabs. I mean, I used to believe that you know, vaccines were one of the miracles of medical science, and that it was kind of the thing you did before you went on holiday. If you went to Africa or somewhere, you'd get your yellow fever or whatever. But I don't recall in all the jabs I've taken ever being made bedridden for 3 days. Did that not
it was literally like a lightning bolt in my head. That's how it felt. It's just, I felt a bit disorientated when it happened, and a bit, you know, when you stand up, felt a bit dizzy, and that was all it amounted to. Luckily it was transient and it passed. Luckily, I mean, since then, I would probably say I'm not the sort of, I mean, I'm getting on a bit these days, so my exercise tolerance will naturally wane. But when I go to the gym, I'm not doing the distance that I used to do on the treadmill. Brain fogs, that happens a lot now. It may happen during this interview where I just lose the train of thought. You know, I did used to have a pretty sharp brain, and it's kind of not as sharp as it was. So brain fogs is another one, very commonly reported by a lot of people on the mild end of the vaccine injury spectrum.
So there must have been... There must be loads and loads of doctors out there who have succumbed to this. Well, you had both the emotional blackmail and straightforward blackmail. The emotional blackmail was the death of your friends, and you were some kind of disrespecting your friend in a way if you didn't take precautions, you know. And the second one was job career blackmail. If you didn't get the jab, you'd get got.
Yeah, lots of, I mean, interestingly, at that time, I wasn't chased around for a flu jab. The last couple of years, it's been really interesting that, you know, you get asked a cursory, would you like the flu jab this year, Dr. Cartland? You say no. End of story, end of issue. And that's been the same for 10 years, really. I've took it, mainly not because I tend to get flu afterwards, ironically. So chose the last 3 years not to, but no one's chased me around. So, I mean, they literally chased me around for 3 weeks, I'd say, with this, you know, offer of jab number two.
Who's there?
It was only when they came... my current employers at the time of GP surgery that I worked at. And so, you know, I succumbed to that pressure and took it as a kind of self-preservation for my own job. And my wife did at the same time to kind of offer me mutual support in that. She knew that I'd been poorly with the first one. However, then they came knocking on my door, what, some 2 months after, saying you need another one. And that's when my kind of eureka moment happened of, hang on a minute. I've never had to have three flu jabs a year. And knowing at the time, you know, that the novel technology that was being used, you know, nowhere in this world have we ever used mRNA vaccines ever on the public, let alone on the whole world, man, woman and child, you know, and watching this happen was quite alarming at the time.
Okay. So what you're saying now sounds to me a pretty damning indictment of the medical profession. Because look, okay, so not all of them have spent as long at university.
I started yet.
Okay, yeah. I know we're going. It was going to escalate, which is good. But I just want to just go through some of those details. So, but you have the first shot and you get knocked sideways for 3 days. Now that is abnormal. You've hinted that your wife may have had adverse reactions, and you were suspicious about the way that they came chasing you to make sure. By the way, you say they actually knocked on your door.
No, as in there were just every opportunity, you know, there's a spare dose going here, there's a spare dose. So it was a metaphorical chasing,
okay.
Really.
But, okay, so all doctors across the country, and in fact around the world, would have had a similar experience to you. And being doctors, they should theoretically know about health and vaccine side effects and so on. And they would also know what you said, that they don't come chasing you after if you haven't had a flu jab. So this combination of things, you would have thought, ought to have alerted lots and lots of doctors to the problem. And we haven't even got onto vaccine injuries yet. Why is nobody, why are these doctors?
Well, I'll go through my own experience. I mean, when I had those two jabs, they weren't fully, I mean, we can talk about informed consent a bit later, but that I didn't receive any information myself. I mean, it's new technology even to me. My injector on both occasions, I literally walked in, rolled up my sleeve, checked who I said I was, and that was the end of it. I wasn't told about any adverse reaction reporting systems or anything. Because I was a doctor, they kind of expected, I guess, that no one after my second jab asked me if I was okay after the first one, for example. It was done down at a fishing village in Cornwall, and you know, all the fishermen were being done. It's literally like a conveyor belt, treadmill of people, one after the other, 3 minutes apart. It was like cattle herding, it was.
Yeah.
And people vaccinating, by the way, weren't even trained to do so, to be honest. I mean, I've said that in other interviews. People that were, the doctors weren't vaccinating, the nurses weren't vaccinating on the whole. They were unqualified. I say unqualified, they were students or administrative staff, you know, pharmacy technicians, pharmacists. They weren't people who were doctors or nurses. You know, they did a few, but usually you find the doctors and nurses consenting, actually, or consenting.
So you smelt a rat fairly early on. Why did none of your colleagues?
That's a brilliant question. And even now, I mean, when the with each passing week, you know, the evidence for adverse events, you know, this all-cause mortality that we're seeing directly induced. I mean, I've just finished before we came on air typing up a note of a poor chap who became paralysed from the waist down after the vaccine. Yeah, he's been passed from pillar to post by doctor.
Not in your surgery.
No, this is, I do a telemedicine service, so a poor chap's contacted me in absolute desperation, really, and lost the use of his legs within 2 weeks of the AstraZeneca. And he was in hospital, he was called a medical mystery, even though he had a very barn door case of something. Again, I don't want to break confidentiality. No. You know, he'd allow me to speak about it to this depth. But yeah, I mean, he's still fully disabled. I mean, I could tell you 1,000 stories of people who have contacted me, either privately or, you know, by the telemedicine service.
Well, actually, tell me.
Just some of the stories.
Tell me some of those 1,000 stories. I'd love to know what kind of adverse reactions you've been hearing.
I mean, I've seen it all, James. I've seen absolutely everything. So I'll give you a week in the life of Dr. Cartland back in the first surgery when the vaccine rollout started. There was one particular week where I had 2 death certificates come into the surgery that I'd spotted on the administrative system. There were postmortems from 2 40-year-old well women, completely well, never been to the doctors in weeks or months. One was 42 and one was 44, all died within 7 days of the vaccine, AstraZeneca. And then the same day, I was duty doctor. I got a call from the local neurosurgical registrar saying that we've got one of your gentlemen come into the hospital. He's got brain clot, cavernous venous thrombosis. And lo and behold, you look at when he had the vaccine and it was the AstraZeneca, it was the day before. And so I took that to my boss at the time and said, look, guys, we've had two deaths in one afternoon. You know, these are confirmed deaths. These aren't up for speculation. They're death certificates with vaccine-induced thrombocytopenia. And the third case was within 24 hours of AstraZeneca getting a brain clot and having to have 6 months of anticoagulant treatment, which they tried to pin on a sinus issue, which he just didn't have any symptoms of, that he'd got some sinus inflammation that had triggered a brain clot and just got shut down. When I said, actually, this guy had a vaccine 24 hours ago, do you think it could be that? To which he just said, be a good chap, referring to ENT, put the phone down, end of story. Reported it to my boss at the time, and he just cracked on with, guess what, vaccinating with the AstraZeneca jab. That such is a dissonance. So that particular afternoon was the kind of tip of the iceberg. And I've seen everything from people coming in saying, I just don't feel right, my brain fogs, you know, exercise tolerance is rubbish, to death, to neurological stuff, to autoimmune conditions going off the scale, such as their thyroiditis or rheumatological issues. Everything, neurological ones seem to be the one that peak at the moment. Things like the chap I've just mentioned who had sudden onset paralysis. A recent teleconsultation I did was a woman who worked in the Navy. And she took the vaccine because it's part of the, you know, you need to remain in service, you need to take it. And since the day she took the vaccine, has lost muscle waste. She's got muscle wasting. She drops to the floor and has muscle fasciculation episodes. A voice gives up on her all the time. She loses the power and strength of her voice. She's struggling to breathe even now. And she's just been passed around by a GP, you know. And it's incredible what's being let to happen in the medical profession at the moment. You know, all these deaths that are coming through and blood clots that are coming through and cancer referrals that I'm doing, you know, there's no place to hide these things. And you ask your colleagues, are you seeing the same thing? Which they must be, because I'm seeing a noticeable increase in things like the presentations I've mentioned. On top of that, things like blood clots, you know, I'm noticing that I'm sending a lot more query DVTs into the local hospital to be scanned. PEs coming back out of hospital with discharge summary saying, unprovoked PE. You look at the vaccination record and 2 weeks, lo and behold, ago, they had the vaccine. It's an incredible amount of, I don't know, dissonance. I don't know. They just don't, people don't seem to, the lights seem to be on and no one seems to be home at the moment with these professionals. You know, when people are dropping like flies, literally.
So they put unprovoked PE, pulmonary embolism, because they don't want to admit that this was very much a provoked PE.
Yeah, I mean, in the same way that they were quite happy to stamp that question COVID-19 on pretty much anyone who coughed death certificate 12 months ago, the same correlation in terms of when somebody dies within a set vicinity of the jab itself, no one wants to actually correlate the two. It's almost committing blasphemy to even put it in the differential diagnosis that the vaccine could be on the list of potential causes for a clot, a death, a cancer. I mean, at the time I was doing a lot of cancer referrals. So I do a cancer referral once a month, and it's quite a complicated form that you have to fill in, and you have to do an audit trail, so it takes quite a time, so you remember when you've done one. And I was doing about 2 or 3, 4 sometimes a week, and I only do 2 days a week. Younger and younger people with gynecological 2-week wait, criteria fulfilled, bowel issues, so bleeding rectally. And at the same time, you've got doctors not seeing patients still. So they're still doing this telephone triage, even now, even this week, I've worked at surgeries that don't see the patients unless they absolutely have
even
to.
Even now?
It's all telephone triage. Even now. I work in surgeries that have got Perspex sheets up, you know, still elbow bumping, still sat in their office on their own with masks. You know, I'm currently suspended from work for not wearing a mask.
Tell me about that briefly.
Yeah, so I went into work. I work at an urgent care centre. So it's like a step down from A&E, mainly for primary care, walk-in presentations, and started doing my shift. Saw a lady. They'd mandated that week that the masks had become mandatory again due to an uptick in cases. Previous to that, the masks were only being made to be worn in certain parts of the building. You know, coronavirus only attacks, you know, standing people rather than sitting.
Yeah,
only attacks A&E, departments of urgent care. So, you know, working away, saw the first patient, kicked her out. Discharged, should I say, and got a tap on the shoulder from the matron, you need to put a mask on, to which my response was, look, it's 32 degrees here, you wouldn't make your dog wear a mask in this, and I don't want to wear one, thank you. I wore them all last summer and they made me irritable, drowsy, just don't want to breathe. And you know, I've read a lot of studies around masks being completely futile, and you know, a recent Nature article showed that there's quite the petri dish on the face side of these masks. Now, that's a published journal. So I don't really want bacteria in my face for the whole. Anyway, long and short of it, you can't work here then with that mask, Dr. Cartland. I said, well, you've just let me see that patient. By the way, that patient's been sat in the department for 6 hours without a drink. You know, so we're talking about health and safety here. And I've told you I'm personally poorly. Do you want a doctor that's drowsy and irritable working with the patients? And anyway, what about this room full of patients that we've got here, 16 at the time? And there's me and another doctor who was due to finish. So it was only me left. And they said, well, we'll have to shut the department then. I don't know if they did in the end, because I've had literally no contact. I've been paid now for 3.5-4 weeks. I've not received any contact from anyone other than the chief medical officer, who kind of deflected me onto an occupational health consultant who was very much on side, let's say, signatory to the Great Barrington Declaration. So it was a relief to see somebody that was awake and basically told them that it was nonsense and unfit to work with that mask on. I've not heard anything. I should have been working now as we speak. Fit and healthy. By the way, I'm submitting before each shift, I do a negative test to prove that I haven't got the disease, that I have to wear the mask to stop me spreading to people. And the person I'm seeing has also got probably 3 jabs down and masks on and a visor on. So I don't see why I'm a biohazard in that scenario. And equally, I work for that same trust in another position, seeing probably the most sickest in society, homeless people. They're the most immunosuppressed people on the streets. I'm allowed to work in that job. I've been allowed to work throughout the whole suspension doing that job. So I'm a biohazard in that room and I'm not a biohazard in this room. However, yesterday, the gift that keeps on giving, they sent an email out saying the very masks that I'm suspended from the trust work-wise from wearing, for not wearing one, have been suspended and banned with immediate effect because there's safety concerns around them. You can't write this stuff. So like, I'm still not working today again. I've not had confirmation whether I should be or not, but it's nonsense. I mean, they blow holes in their own logic, really, well, flawed logic.
You've been suspended for not wearing a mask, which turns out to have been rejected by the medical establishment because it's potentially dangerous. That's just glorious.
With a negative test, which the receipt that what I received back from the negative testing was, it could be false negative. Which I obviously said, well, what's the blinking point of doing these things if we're not going to abide by the result? Anyway, long and short of it, it's the occupational health consultants agreed fully with my, you know, my position. And I've got asthma as well. So, you know, putting a mask over an asthmatic is not really something you should be doing. You know, you get a breathless patient in A&E, first thing they do is stick a face mask on. That just, even to a non-medic, is counterproductive. Why would you put something over the face of somebody who can't breathe? Just at basic first principle.
I hate to say this, Dave. I'm going to ask you, actually. Why do you think you're an asthmatic?
Why? I'm only seasonal asthmatic, to be honest. So my situation is just pollen.
But even so, yeah, I'm a just seasonal pollen, hay fever sufferer, but I've got a pretty good idea of why I've got all these kind of these autoimmune whatever ailments. You know, I mean,
I've seen the studies recently about the correlation between the numbers of vaccinations and the number of atopic conditions and autism and ADHD and all that sort of stuff. So it's something I've not really been down the rabbit hole of too much, other than to say I've seen presentations that are pretty robust with their evidence base of, you know, morbidity in patients that have had multiple vaccines through their life. And you look at compare it to communities that don't touch vaccines, like the Amish community. They don't go near vaccines, and they're doing all right, thank you.
Yeah. I can see that they would want to eliminate those control groups. You've seen them.
I mean,
I've not
just had my local trust come after me, James. I've had the GP, GMC have been after me. NHS England have been after me, both of which are now closed cases. But just the fact that, you know, me speaking, I always make sure that I'm evidencing everything I say, everything I do. Everything's got a reference or a citation attached to it. Unfortunately, that doesn't get reciprocated back to me. So people can make wild claims of this vaccine is safe and effective, for example, in pregnancy. I'm allowed to probe and ask and say, well, where is that from? What study are you citing to be able to confidently say that it's 100% safe? I mean, I did an interview where I've actually held up the advertising campaign from the Royal Obs and Gynae College that say there are absolutely no issues around vaccinating pregnant women. You know, the studies haven't been done, and the ones that were done, the Pfizer data, for example, are pretty damning. The fact that we can even come near a pregnant lady with a needle, given the data that we know, and obviously it was tried to be locked away, but they've had to release it in three data dumps. And, you know, I've been deep into those pages. You know, my colleagues don't even know what the Pfizer data dump is, let alone what mRNA is. So this is the issue we've got.
I don't know whether you remember, I know you're a fan of the Delling product. It was like quite early on, I spoke to a whistleblower who was a receptionist in a GP's surgery. And lots of people said, oh, she's not real and, you know, whatever. But I mean, she definitely was. And I she's been completely vindicated by subsequent events. And she was reporting all these adverse events after, you know, vaccinated patients. And she said the doctors in the surgery didn't care because all they wanted was that throughput of money, you know, paid for their sports cars and parked outside. So I can see that greed or sort of, yeah, greed, I suppose, would be one reason why doctors are reluctant to speak out. But has that been your experience, or is it more than that? Is it just that they haven't a bloody clue?
I think it's multifactorial, really, because ultimately, you know, the money they're being paid isn't big money. They get 15 quid a go times three per patient. So if they've got a 10,000 patient list, it's not... It does add up, absolutely, but they're not going to buy a Lamborghini out of the property. I mean, it's clearing their debts for starters.
So in an average GP, how many patients would an average GP have on his or her books?
Well, the surgeries I've worked at are circa 10,000.
Okay.
So 10,000. So, I mean,
15 quid a jab. So times three, 45.
Yeah. Obviously, some of those are young. So again, I don't know what proportions would be, but yeah, 10,000 times 45 quid.
Okay.
Taking out a few young
so,
kids.
Well, that's 450,000. That's quite a lot for a surgery. I mean, that's not, you know, nice work if you can get it. I mean, if there's three doctors, it's not bad. But do you think there's an element of sort of willful self-denial, as if you've spent all this time accumulating this knowledge, which is very much wrapped up in the pharmaceutical industry, which effectively dictates what you can and can't prescribe? And they're so invested in the system that they can't escape mentally. Even is that? Would that
yeah, be- I mean, in doctors, there's a lot of ego in doctors. You know, it's hard for the average human being to admit they're wrong. It's just human nature, isn't it? So these doctors, you know, we have been, and I've talked in other interviews about, you know, we have been kind of plugged into pharmaceutical. You know, everything's an algorithm, everything's a pathway, and it all leads to a drug at the end of it usually, even in the GP program, you're supposed to be quite holistic about your approach to patients. But these days, because we're doing telephone consultations, very limited time with a patient, it's very much kind of, you've got to give a pill for every ill, make sure everyone's medicated up to the hilt. And, you know, doctors, you know, they've been duped themselves. If it turns out to be what we all think it is, or know it is, should I say, then not only have they been duped themselves, they've also been, you know, going after pregnant women, children, younger and younger, healthier cohorts. And kind of they're complicit then, aren't they? They're guilty. They're buyer's remorse, call it what you like. They've been actively involved in vaccinating children. And if it turns out that, you know, Dr. Cartland's right with his data on pregnancy that he's got directly from the Pfizer documents or the child data that we've seen at the moment, then actually I had an active hand in that. And so obviously they want Dave Cartland to go away. They're wanting to disappear. I'm a pest to these doctors. In the coffee rooms up and down Cornwall, I'm a pest to them. And all I'm doing is very politely just showing them data on things like myocarditis, pregnancy, the Pfizer docs, and just go away, Dave. We don't want to hear this. Go away, you COVIDiot, you conspiracy theorist or whatever you are. And I'm just giving them data, really. So, you know, they don't want me reminding and poking at them that actually they are actively complicit. And I'm just calling on those doctors at the moment to that do know. Actually, you can see it in their eyes with an immediate effect of having a conversation that they know.
Do they?
The more senior the doctor, the quicker they exit the room. They do. They do, absolutely. I mean, I've so many taps on the shoulder the last 2 or 3 weeks, actually. It's starting to give me evidence that the dam's starting to burst because doctors, nurses, injectors, that not only have they had vaccine regret themselves because they're poorly themselves, or they're onto their fourth bout of COVID after having had 3 or 4 vaccines. You know, that's absolutely... Everyone knows somebody who's got COVID at the moment, and you can bet your house that they're treble or quadruple jabbed. But, you know, thank God they had the vaccine because they've been in ITU, but that doesn't bear out in the data either. It's absolute nonsense.
So in your estimation, have most doctors taken the jab themselves?
Other than I think about, I mean, there were 100,000 NHS staff that were due to be sacked. NHS 100K is an organisation that was set up to go against the mandate. So I think a few of them succumbed. You know, I have close contact to the probably about 20,000 that succumbed, personal friends that actually took that decision to save their job, like I did with the second vaccine. They did it with the third because they were trying to make them have the third jab. And, you know, they've had health issues ever since. You know, one particular girl went into SVT, which is a heart arrhythmia, the day after, and had a blood clot the very day after that as well. So, and that was within a 24-hour period. She's got a heart arrhythmia and a blood clot on her lung 24 hours after the jab, you know, and there's blood on the hands of these doctors, and they need calling out, really, because they don't know the basics. I bumped into my vaccinator, actually, by complete chance on Monday, just gone. And I tried to quiz her on some of the basics, like, do you know what mRNA is? Do you know it's a gene therapy rather than, you know, a conventional vaccine? Do you know how it actually works by mechanism? Do you know this spike protein? Do you know what it can do? Do you know any of the studies that show that it crosses the brain barrier, the blood-brain barrier, the studies that show that it accumulates in testicles and ovaries? You know what? Just completely went over her head. This is a senior GP, this is. I pinned another senior GP down as well at lunch break on Tuesday, and they just scarp her out the door. They disappear. And like I say, you can see it in somebody's eyes if they're telling the porky. And same here. You can tell when they're... when they're complicit in something. You know, I don't know. I don't know if the average doctor, like the average punter in the public, I don't think they are fully complicit with the darkness that's going on here. They're just doing what they're told. You know, I've had people approach me and say, we just did what we were told. I had a group of nurses that were all many, many vaccines to their name, and one was pregnant, actually. And I had a bit of an audience with them on Monday just gone. And they listened to every word, and they just said, Dave, I can't believe, A, the censorship and the way you've been treated. You've been really polite and presented things very calmly. All the doctors had gone by that point, by the way. And the nurses, you could see, they were grey. They literally were stunned, particularly the pregnant one, when I told her there was a 1 in 4 chance of a severe adverse reaction as per the Pfizer trial data. Utterly stunned.
Yes. Well, I mean, if anyone's going to be see it firsthand, vaccine damage, it's going to be doctors and nurses. And I thought that that was why there was particular resistance, and well, certainly from nurses especially, that they, you know, they seen what it does, and they weren't going to even, they're prepared to risk their careers because they didn't want to die. So it amazes me that doctors still went ahead given they could see the side of
none of it makes sense. I mean, the more totalitarian measures are being brought out daily, particularly in America now, and you just see that it doesn't correlate with the severity of the disease we're talking about here. So when we're talking about COVID anyway, I mean, it's quiet back in the day. I always talk about, you know, when I was working in Birmingham at the time, first part of the pandemic, very quiet, very chilled out, you know, loads of gaps in the schedule. No one was coming to you. Very, very quiet. And that was at the peak. And now, I mean, I speak to all the Omicron patients, and if they've got a snotty nose and achy muscles and flu-like symptoms, that's as bad as it gets. So why are we going so, you know, pressurized on, you know, locking things down and the impact of all those sort of measures that were not medication related, but pressurizing younger and younger children with healthier and healthier past medical histories? There is just no Now, when you look at risk benefit analysis, it's all risk and zero benefit. And that bears out in the data when you look at things like numbers needed to treat of children, that you have to give 4 million children a jab to stop one ITU admission. There's only been less than 10 deaths in under 16s within 28 days of a positive test. I mean, that in itself is a load of nonsense when you look at a measure of measuring mortality within a pandemic. But less than 10. So what, they're going for every single child just for under 10. And I think the figure was actually 4 children or under 16s died. Pregnancy, 13 pregnant women. And that's reported by the Royal Obs and Gynae College. Up until the end of the Delta wave, 13 women died within 28 days of a positive COVID test. So they could have died from anything. They could have had preeclamptic fit, dropped down on the floor and, had a heart attack, but they had a positive test. So that would have gone down. So the 13 deaths, yeah, there were two plus, I think 2.1 million pregnancies in that same time frame. So they vaccinated all of those people. And at the same time, the MHRA have come out in July 2021 saying we should not be vaccinating pregnant women and breastfeeding women. Yet in December 2020, they were, going for healthcare, pregnant healthcare workers, at risk, inverted commas, pregnant females, And so it doesn't make sense that the – and same with JCVI and children advising that we shouldn't be doing this. And yet someone somewhere seems to be overruling the actual bodies that are there to advise upon safety and should we proceed with vaccinating children, JCVI. They said no, yet they somehow proceeded within close proximity of that decision being made. It was overruled and they've gone for younger and younger and younger as we've seen. They're going for 5-year-olds now. There's absolutely no case for a 5-year-old to be vaccinated.
I was interested to read in your Substack that you wrote a while back that when you graduated at the ceremony, you read out you recited the first Do No Harm, the Hippocratic Oath. Is that right?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm in the phasing out now. It's like you can conscientiously object, if you like, to reading that out at graduation, which I find really odd anyway. That's across all the universities now, but I had an option to read the Hippocratic Oath.
Because I've heard this. I've in my days as a sort of mainstream media journalist, I would sometimes invoke the Hippocratic Oath and say all doctors have to say this and, why aren't they obeying it? And interestingly, some of the responses I would get from doctors would be, oh, you ignorant fool. You don't know. We don't have to say this anymore. But the implication of what they were saying, it was like, this is so old hat, this idea that the Hippocratic Oath, you're so out of touch, daddy-o, you're so, and I thought, why would this be, rather as you did, why would anyone object to the idea that your first duty was to do no harm? It seems to be a no-brainer, but yet the corruption of the medical system, tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I remember the moments it came from my lips, primum non nocere, which is first do no harm. And I remember it's emotional because you're making a vow, a solemn vow, really. I mean, there are bits of the Hippocratic Oath that probably need polishing up and bringing up today, but it's still an oath. And, the same reason I keep trying to remind doctors that remember that day in your medical school interview where you were asked, why do you want to be a doctor? When you have a shower in the morning and put your scrubs on, remember what you're going out to achieve on that. This shift today that you're going to do, you want to help people, you want to keep patients as your first concern, you want to be holistic in your approach, patient safety is paramount, and essentially don't do any harm, don't do anything if it causes any harm. And there are just clear signals, and I talked about in that article, signals of harm, they're more than signals these days, they're, massive signals of, not only the all-cause mortality stuff that we see now, more people are dying younger than ever, but it should mean a lot to doctors. That oath, it does mean a lot to me. I mean, it's what I've built my whole career on, really, to do that. But it seems to be a kind of optional extra now.
Well, I'll tell you where it is particularly, and that is in the field of vaccination. And I'll tell you, I'll give an illustration of this. I don't know whether you listened to the one where I talked about my awkward encounter with Kate Bingham, the woman who was put in charge of the vaccine rollout program. She was at the same college as me, and we went to our college reunion and I bumped into her in the quad, and we were having drinks, and I thought, she's an old friend, so I thought, I was hoping she was going to say to me, look, I feel slightly embarrassed because we never meant to vaccinate children and people who weren't in the at-risk groups. I don't know how it happened, and I found myself being sold a pup. But she didn't say that. I asked her about vaccine injuries, and she brushed it off rather crossly. She said, "You don't know what you're talking about. You know, you've got no scientific or medical background, A. But B," she said, "of course you get collateral damage when you have a mass vaccination program." And what fascinated me was a woman who I've always thought as really, you know, great mother, great human being, caring, nice, jolly, capable, was prepared to just write off people like, I mean, I didn't mention him, but Alex Mitchell, the guy who lost one of his legs because of the massive clotting, and all those people, or maybe even your friend who, she didn't die of a vaccine, did she? But you know, of all these, the suffering that what are called life-changing injuries. And here was the woman in charge of this program, and it was like, yeah, whatever, you know. So she was not obeying the Hippocratic Oath, was she?
Well, not only that, I mean, the probably one of the reasons that led to my resignation, I actually resigned over this kind of complicity and ignorance, really, that doctors and nurses were presented. I mean, I did pull the two senior partners and say, do you agree with this data? And they agreed not to vaccinate children. At that very moment, they said, absolutely, there's absolutely no evidence we should be giving them this. And actually, the evidence you presented here is damning. I remember the words he used. It's the evidence is damning. Now, both of those doctors and other nurses, all equally involved in vaccinating children, said to me that day, we wouldn't vaccinate our own children, yet would go down the vaccine centre and vaccinate your children. That to me is not only a Hippocratic Oath kind of
violation.
No, it's ethically abhorrent. It's disgusting. Why would you not vaccinate your own children, yet go and vaccinate a complete stranger who's actually a patient?
This anecdote, before I forget, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it is kind of germane. I was at this amazing festival the other weekend, the Hope Freedom Festival, and it was just full of awake people. And I was chatting late at night to this guy called TP Pete, and TP Pete's been down the rabbit hole since the 1970s, and he goes to festivals and puts up teepees. anyway, we were talking about Glastonbury, and have you ever been to Glastonbury Festival?
Not actually. No. It's on the to-do list.
It's big. I've been going for many years, and I've always gone with a press ticket because it gives you access to the backstage area, and if you haven't got one of those, you know, hospitality passes, then basically you're with the cattle class. And you have to go longer way round to reach the stages. You can't take shortcuts, and you can't hang out with the slebs at the backstage and all this. And I was saying to TPP, I couldn't bear going to Glastonbury without one of those hospitality passes. And he said, yeah. And that's exactly how the elites think too about us. They look at us and they go, well, we want one rule for us and we want another rule for everyone else. They don't count. We're the ones that matter. And he said, as above, so below. And it made me realize, actually, we've got to get past this mindset where we think we belong to a special category and everyone else can just get treated like shit, which is exactly the mentality that your doctor colleagues were adopting. You know, I wouldn't vaccinate my own children, but yeah, other people's, you know, they're just useless.
Yeah, well, interesting. More on that subject. I mean, there's some footage come out just recently of the great Dr. Bourla, the Pfizer chief executive. He's basically saying he's never had the vaccine. You know, one today that's been doing the rounds is Dr. Tedros. He's not had his either. Yeah, he's had a Twitter image of him pretending to have one.
He's a fraud. Alberto Bourla is a bullfrog. I mean, I think he's half human and half or you've seen the videos.
I've seen them, yeah.
Look, as a doctor, have you ever seen that before? Have you ever seen somebody's throat?
I've seen the video and it's incredible. Yeah, it's incredible.
If somebody came into your surgery, I've got this problem, doctor.
I'd probably call the vet. Yeah. There's a lot of neck stuff going on in these kind of elites, isn't there? There's a lot of weird neck activity going on, which is odd.
I'm not going to speculate. Dave, you're not as far down the rabbit hole as me. I think there is no question that there are these kind of subspecies or hybrid species, I think, that at that level, people like Alberto Buller and, I mean, he's not the only one. These have been witnessed, these people with these, they're kind of shape-shifting, I don't know what they are. They're not altogether human. So I'm thinking maybe he knows that these mRNA things would really mess him up if he took one. You know, they'd mess with his frog, stroke, reptile, whatever.
Well, we know they mess things up. I mean, I only watched this week, World Council for Health, and they had two very good scientists speaking out, Pierre Corey, Ryan Cole, very, very slick presentations. And throughout both presentations, they both presented multiple citations and references of studies of what this mRNA is actually doing to the body. We know this. These are published in international journals from across the world, and they go through what the spike proteinopathy, I think they call it. So when we're giving the body the code for this spike protein, you know, the most toxigenic pro-inflammatory part of the virus itself, so we're giving the instruction for the human cell to make it. That didn't sit right. That was one of my really early kind of scientific objections to it. We're training a body here to produce a spike protein. Like, what's that about? And anyway, what we know about the spike protein now, it crosses the blood-brain barrier. It causes all sorts of pro-inflammatory reactions, metastatic reactions, i.e. cancer causing, you know, all the mechanisms in the body that we know prevent you from developing a tumor. You know, the immune system's there to fight infection, but it's also there to screen for mutant cells. You know, if they do spot a cancer, an early cancer cell, they gobble them up essentially. And that immune system is geared to do that so that everyone doesn't get cancer, essentially. But also, you know, DNA accumulates damage over life from the elements, the sun, radiation, you know, all this sort of stuff. And actually there are plasters being stuck on these damaged bits of DNA. And actually we know this spike protein most definitely, you know, suppresses and affects that tumor suppression gene, you know, tidy up operation that the body does. So, you know, we've got a ticking time bomb here. And we're seeing early signs of it now. I mean, I've been working in the surgery this last couple of weeks. It's like the winter. People on their third course of antibiotics, they're 30. You look at the jab status, and they're 3. I mean, I keep talking about these two particular conditions because you don't see them very often. And I saw 2 or 3 shingles this week. I mean, if you see a shingles every 6 months, that's all you see. And I remember the words that came from the patient's mouth. You know, I've never had this problem before. This is my second bout of shingles. It's absolutely agony, doctor. It's only been since I've had the last vaccine, the booster. So shingles is one that I've seen a hell of a lot. I mean, I've seen about 6 or 7 cases in a fortnight. Now, shingles represents an immune system that's not working very well. It's a latent virus that comes out to play when you run down and your immune system doesn't work. Same as like herpes zoster on the lips. When you get herpes simplex, when you get a cold sore reactivation, when you run down. So the other thing I'm seeing, you know, I've seen one case of Bell's palsy in 14 years. I've seen 3 in a fortnight. 3 in a fortnight. Bell's palsy, again, it's an activation of a virus in the facial nerve. And so you get stroke-like appearance. Justin Bieber, for example, had a version of that, Ramsey Hunt. You know, and these are just evidences that the immune systems aren't working. So these people, I would suggest, actually, that they are vaccine injured, but just don't know it yet. And that's my big concern, that there's going to be a torrent of dissidents. Well, I've got to be careful when I'm working at a locum surgery as a locum, because I want to be asked back, to be honest. So, I mean, I'm already dominating the coffee room discussions at the minute to try and wake their own doctors up so they can tell their own patients that they're vaccine injured. But it's kind of like an agency doctor thing that I do.
Does it have any traction? Have you converted anybody?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the last 2 weeks, massively, I've had doctors come in, you know, after the coffee room, everyone's gone and dispersed. I've had a registrar doctor this week sit with me while I went through one of my interviews, and we kept stopping it, pausing it and discussing the data. I showed him the reference, and he went grey. He went grey and he walked out. He was actually, his legs were shaking. And I've had a paramedic do the same. I've had another doctor, as we walked up the stairs after coffee, saying, didn't want to say in the coffee room, Dave, but absolutely brilliant what you said there. This is why I know they know. And doctors from up in the Midlands getting in touch saying, I've seen your work, I've seen your interviews, fair play to you, well done for speaking out, admire your integrity, etc. I've been vaccinating children, I've been vaccinating pregnant women. I don't know what I've been doing, Dave. I've seen what you've said. I mean, it's so obvious, it's so clear. So there's these 1 or 2 doctors stepping out of the shadows now. The ones that do just want their anonymity, really, I think I'd say. They haven't got the courage to speak out on an interview. Look, at the end of the day, I've also got a mortgage. You know, they talk about their mortgage. You know, I'd speak out, but for my mortgage. They talk about it like I haven't got that financial obligation to pay my own mortgage. You know, we took the oath. We took the oath. You know, that's what makes me talk out. I hate speaking out in public. Absolutely hate it. Used to hate it at medical school. I don't like any attention. But the message is so important to humanity that it needs to be said. You know, I don't know how these doctors sleep at night. I really don't.
Well, do you feel on any level that you've been chosen?
Chosen? Chosen by what? By God?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a Christian as well. I don't know if you knew that. Yeah, I mean, there's a one. Do you know what? Just to deflect the question in slightly, and we'll come from a different angle about it, is that, you know, in all of this, the people that I've struggled to kind of speak to openly and have an open debate about a spiritual battle, you know, a good and evil, a dark light, call it what you like, is the church people, Christians are in the church. And these are churches that call out kind of Pharisee type behavior in other Christians,
yeah.
You know, and I've been kind of cut loose by my own church down here in Penzance. You know, it's a difficult situation. I can't get my head around that. But yeah, in terms of, you know, I do see this as a spiritual battle. Absolutely. This is dark. I mean, if we're right and they're vaccinating children and, you know, in full knowledge of the detrimental effects to people's health, then there's some darkness behind that. And we can but speculate as to what is behind that darkness.
Yeah.
I'm sure we both agree, you know, as Christians, what's behind that darkness.
We totally do agree. I mean, this has been the most fascinating 2 years of my life. The learning, it's been like a sort of, it's a condensed university, a PhD course in rabbit holes and truth and hidden truth. And I wanted to ask you, one of the conclusions I've reached is that, okay, if my leg got accidentally fell off while I was fox hunting, say, I'd probably go to a surgery to get that sorted out, to get it stitched back on. But almost every conceivable medical problem, and that would definitely include cancer, there's no way I'd go and see a GP or a regular medic anymore. My faith in the mainstream profession has been so shattered, and I don't know whether you've looked into the history of allopathic medicine, the Flexner report in the early 20th century, when medicine was hijacked by Carnegie and Rockefeller, who wanted to push their petroleum byproducts and create this new industry. Do you ever wonder whether those 10 years you spent were a bit like learning, I don't know, gender studies or race studies, you know, complete bollocks, basically, that sounded credible. Was actually...
Well, yeah, I mean, I do. I feel personally duped, you know. I spent a lot of money on those degrees, you know, tuition fees and things, and you only realise with retrospect that actually you were just taught to be a drug pusher. You know, that's exactly what you are. I mean, I've learned a whole new degree in the last 6 months, as well as all the other stuff going on around trying to evidence everything I've got a perspective on. But, you know, the rabbit holes of the allopathic medicine, naturopathic stuff, you know, learning from other doctors, you know, very, very eminent doctors in the field, and just learning about anything that's basically cheap and grows from the ground or from a tree, doesn't make big pharma any money. But the testimonies of people that have used things, you know, from a tree or a leaf that is naturally occurring, or even things like the sunlight and vitamin D and basic trace elements that you get from natural things. You don't get those lectures in medical school. I've been asked, you know, how many nutrition. No, or even water. That's what I'm saying. You don't get, you know, I keep saying I may have missed that lecture at med school, that one lecture, but it would have only been one lecture. And I can't remember anything about nutrition, you know, holistic, you know, you kind of get taught almost that people that think outside the box in terms of the, you know, mainstream pharma driven medical protocols that we follow are kind of crazy. You know, even now I find myself when somebody says they're a reflexologist or a herbal doctor or something, you kind of in your mind, you mark them as a bit of a quack, a bit of a lunatic. But actually, you know, when you speak to their patients who they've actually got their because you've been conditioned. So, you know, I've woken up and I came late to the COVID party, to be honest, because I went along with it for not to the point of giving anyone a vaccine, just to put that disclaimer in, never did do that, because it was so blatantly obvious from the start. But the speaking out came in the second half. And, you know, as you say, it's information overload. You almost are having to reprogram that indoctrination and just open your mind again to actually real medicine. So, yeah, these are places that I'm going now in the next few months.
I feel because it's very easy to dwell on the negative stuff, and it's fascinating to dwell on the conspiracy stuff, to all the everything from Titanic and JFK to the PCR tests and the whole vaccine scam and the plandemic and all this stuff. It's very easy to dwell on the horror and deviousness and satanic evil of what these people are doing and have done for generations. But it's the thing that people talk about less is what kind of world we want to live in if and when we defeat these bastards. And it seems to me that one of the things that our new world will look like is that it will be free of allopathic medicine, because it's a monstrous aberration. It's a rejection of all those wonderful things that we've discovered through the ages, all the herbs and all the kind of acupuncture and all these different techniques we've learned to work with our immune system, which have been suppressed and rejected. I'll give you one example. Well, back in the day when I was fighting the environmentalists and the loons, I noticed that the same kind of people who were really, really aggressive towards me and were trying to kind of destroy me simply for questioning the whole climate change agenda. And they do that. I mean, they want to destroy you. They don't want to argue with you because they've got no arguments. The same people were really, really, really against homeopathy. And I was thinking, well, is homeopathy a threat? You know, I mean, if people want to go to a homeopath, why not?
But it's the same people who are walking around with placards saying pro-choice about the abortion debate, you know, my body, my choice. And then you've seen videos, I'm sure you have, where the people are interviewing them saying, okay, I agree, your body, your choice. What about the vaccine? And then you see that kind of response. And like you said, it's not just a, please, I don't want to talk about it. It's an angry, visceral, you know, name call usually, rather than a scientific debate. You know, all I keep asking people is for evidence. I'm not getting deep with them. I'm just saying, look, if you make an outrageous claim that something's 100% safe and 100% effective, you better have something to back that, because I have, to show that it's not safe and effective. But yeah, it's a bizarre phenomenon.
Well, I mean, really well done for standing up. How do you feel after, because I imagine you've lost a lot of income and you're a lot less...
It's kind of been reputational. I mean, when I resigned from my job, they put me on garden leave. So again, a perfectly fit and healthy doctor, 4 months they paid me to be off work in the middle of a killer pandemic. Again, it's just counterintuitive, isn't it? So, I mean, I got through that, had a bit of a detox in terms of in out, breathing the fresh air, walking the coastal paths of Cornwall, back into this job, and obviously ran straight back onto the treadmill of the COVID religion. Like I said, I'm not allowed to work at the moment. Just had an email ping up now saying you're still suspended until next week. So I don't know what's going to go on there. But yeah, I mean, it's stressful. It's absolutely stressful because, you know, I can imagine it's stressful for somebody who isn't a medic, but being working in the circles where you're witnessing firsthand vaccine injuries, and then in the room down the road, they're vaccinating children. You know, it's very difficult, you know, not to chain yourself to the door sometimes, you know, and to make that stand. And I'm harsh on myself that, is there anything more I can do other than these interviews and give my perspective? I mean, all I've tried to do from this, James, is tell my story, what I've seen with my own eyes, using my own scientific logic that I learned through medical school. And you know what? I don't know if you know, but I'm banned from all of social media. So Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, all four have banned me, suspended indefinitely. And every time, I mean, in the run-up to those suspensions, all I do was publish data from the different governments of the world that's pretty damning in nature, to try and wake people up from Nature, The Lancet, British Medical Journal. That was my recent Facebook ban for publishing a BMJ article.
It's a very good publication.
I was suspended for 24 hours for posting that interview that the guy, Matt, forgot his name, the American journalist, going around asking people, what is a woman?
Yeah, yeah.
It was an interview that he did around, he was walking around all the academics, and that was called hate crime. I was told I was permanently suspended because it was a hate crime, apparently. So
you must have been mass reported.
Just posting that shit. Yeah, I mean, when you go on Twitter now, they know who you are. I mean, I've been threatened. They know the names of my children. They know where I live. You know, and then your Facebook gets account, your Twitter account gets nuked, and so you haven't even got that evidence to show the police that your children have been named. So, I mean, even people are sharing my interviews now, and like I say, it's just little old Dr. Cartland down in Cornwall telling his experiences. And do you know what? They're getting banned for sharing my stuff now. If you clicked on Dave Cartland's Instagram, only six weeks ago, before I was banned, you know, it would come up with a banner saying, "Don't click on this doctor. He's a spreader of misinformation." And that's fairly libelous stuff, isn't it? To call a doctor out. And, you know, the reason I overturned an appeal with Twitter, I threatened legal action against them, saying, look, you know, if you're calling it misinformation, you need to point this out. What exactly is the misinformation here in this government data set that's freely available? But they're allowed to call you. And they're doing massive calls now across all of this meta social media. And the people like myself and other doctors that have been brave enough to stand up, they haven't got a voice. Same as the vaccine injured. I was banned from Twitter, the Instagram, for posting that Mark Steen interview where he interviewed two widows. You know, they've lost their husbands. It says it on the death certificate. And they take it down as misinformation. Who's got the power to call it that?
I wanted to ask you, you've seen lots of patients who are clearly vaccine injured. What can you do for them?
Well, the problem is that obviously the mechanism of the injury, you know, it's understanding it like anything. You need to have that understanding of the mechanism of the injury, and we're, you know, you can't even talk about it, let alone do any sort of viable research. So we're only just learning, like I said, looking at that World Council for Health talk just this Monday gone. Excuse me. And so
you've got,
I mean,
COVID, doctor.
I mean, there's lots of protocols. I know, I'm with you. I need to get intubated.
You do?
And give him some midazolam.
I hear that's very effective.
Just gonna have a drink, sorry. It's effective, yeah, at curing COVID, curing life, actually, because you end up in a casket. But
it's like Judge Death.
That's another story. Yeah, if you're dead, you can't get COVID again.
The sentence is death. The crime is life. The sentence is death. You're probably too young for...
Going back to your treatment protocols, I mean, they do exist, James. They do exist. They're around. So if you type in like a vaccine injury protocol, I use a couple I recommend to people that are... One's from the World Council for Health. Again, there's a list of sort of natural supplements that you can use, things like natokinase, vitamins, minerals, things like that, that you can take in high dose. I've got
a medicine cabinet, and
that actually has improved slightly. Yeah, I was going to say NAC, N-acetylcysteine's flying off the shelves. People are using that as a detoxifier. There's things like fasting, you know, the fasting detoxifying diets. Had some recent success with hyperbaric oxygen. One of the cases I mentioned earlier, the girl that was sort of bullied into taking a vaccine and couldn't use her muscles anymore. She had some HBO2, hyperbaric oxygen.
Well, how do you take that?
Improvement immediately after. It's a treatment that you have to seek privately. So it's kind of a hyperbaric, high-pressure oxygen chamber that you lie in. It kind of pushes oxygen into all your cells of the body. And she had a massive improvement. Again, this is all new to me. These are just anecdotal testimonies of individuals, really. Okay. You know, Zelenko had a protocol. Canada, there's one called the FLCCC. We can look at vaccine injury protocols. They're all kind of much of a muchness, similar kind of variations on a theme, really, of what you can do. But, you know, people saying that they've had remarkable results. Some saying nothing at all. So it's worth a try because it's cheap
as
chips.
It's good to hear because, I mean, I can't imagine there's a single person listening to this who hasn't got a loved one who's succumbed to the pressure, which is, after all, enormous. And I don't
Everyone
feel,
knows
I don't feel
someone.
Smug
I keep saying
about
that.
Not having had a death jab. I don't feel like, mm-hmm. You know, my concern is for those who've had them. Because,
yeah.
You know, I mean, it was just a matter of luck, wasn't it, that some of us were sufficiently awake when the rollout program started that we weren't buying it. But, I mean, we're all victims of a lifelong brainwashing program. And we've been trained to trust doctors like yourself, you know, go and see the GP.
Yeah.
That was me up until...
But if you look at the treatment itself, what did Pfizer do? I mean, it was under emergency use authorization. So there was a slight argument at the very beginning that, you know, needs must and let's get this out quickly. But at the end of the day, what did they first do? They took indemnity from prosecution. And the second thing was try to lock up their data for 75 years so no human eye could see it. You know, and I've read all the pages of that data and you wouldn't let your rabbit near these injections, let alone your daughter or your fiance. You know, you'd be running the opposite direction, but people haven't been bothered to read it. The doctors haven't been able to read it. And, you know, all of this stuff is hidden in massive swathes of documentation. So hard to pinpoint the sentences. When I talk about the vaccine as gene therapy, for example, their own documents call it that. So you kind of get called a conspiracy theorist. But one of the interviews that I did, that was, I was very careful to hold up the documents to the camera and read them out. And it calls them, this isn't a conventional vaccine. It's a gene therapy, immunomodulatory treatment. And it's not to be used, I mean, used with caution, particularly on the whole swathes of the population. In their own documents, yeah, like the MHRA example we gave earlier, they're stating these things, yeah, ignoring their own facts and their own data and information. And it's just dark. If I was somebody who was considering the autumn booster, for example, I would think about, you know, not only the censorship of the doctors that are speaking out, that's a big red flag, isn't it? That we're just not even allowed a voice. You know, you can flick on mainstream media, you can't hear about vaccine injuries. I mean, Mark's got in trouble, hasn't he, for just speaking to widows about their dead husbands, you know, that succumbed after. I mean, and he's facing Ofcom for that. I mean, you're not making it up when you've gone, you know, you've got a dead spouse that you've just buried. You know, it's not misinformation. So it's a big red flag for me. And I would just say, anyone considering a vaccine, please, please quiz your vaccinator, ask them. And, you know, they'll stumble on their words. They'll try and dodge and deflect. Ask them, you say it's safe and effective in my cohort. I'm a 17-year-old lad. What's the data on myocarditis? And they will, I guarantee they won't have a clue. They won't have a clue. Just quiz them. Just, I mean, even if you're going to go and have your fourth jab, quiz them, ask them.
Dave, I hope that this podcast maybe saves at least one person. If it saves even one person.
I've said it from the beginning, yeah. One person is all I ask. You know, it's worth all the effort in the world if it stops one, particularly 5 to 17-year-old, you know, and pregnant women. They're the two soapboxes I've stood upon, aside from good medical ethics around informed consent, bodily autonomy. They've been my three big issues. You know, adults are big enough and ugly enough to look into it themselves. You know, I keep talking about, you know, adults can look into this themselves, find the information. I'm kind of almost giving up on trying to convert these people, because it's there, it's publicly available, but they'd rather watch Netflix with that same time that they could be researching this. You know, health is so sacred to a person, yet they'd rather watch Love Island. You know, we're in that Love Island generation. They'd spend an hour watching that nonsense than actually spending an hour in the MHRA or ONS databases and looking on gov.uk for the data that is so in plain sight that actually you can't help these people if they're that far into the trance.
I'll bet you everyone on Love Island is fully vaxxed. It's probably.
Well, did you? I don't know if, I mean, my wife watches it, to be honest. And they had the parents coming in at the end, and I stopped watching at that point. They couldn't hug their relatives that they haven't seen for 6 or 7 weeks. They had to keep 2 meters apart. You know, the natural instinct to hug. And I think in that moment, I kind of realised some of the pantomime that we've done. I mean, I see pictures of the children in schools, in the playground, in hoops on the floor so that they don't go outside of their 2 metres, or masked on their photographs for the end of year photo that they have, with masks on their faces, like hiding the smiles. I mean, you know, it's absolutely disgusting what we've done and what we've let happen, because we've let it happen. We could stop this tomorrow. Every doctor in the world could stand up and say, forget that, stop. You know, all those numbers of people on the fence, there's hundreds and thousands of them. But actually, if you ask anyone who the anti-vaxxers are in this country, you could name them on one hand, probably. Me being one of them, a vaccinated anti-vaxxer.
You're absolutely right. What you say about the medical profession is also true of the journalistic profession. All it would take is, yeah, I mean, like, what? 20 of my prominent former colleagues to just speak out and not write one of those articles where they daringly attack lockdowns and they daringly question whether or not it was a Chinese manufactured bioweapon. But their article always says that, always has that statutory disclaimer about how the vaccines have been safe and effective and that the rollout program has saved thousands of lives. So, and
next time anyone says those hallowed words, James, safe and effective, just say, based upon what data? Because on all of these claims, there's never a reference. If I write a scientific paper, I have to put pages of references, citations. Just, you don't find a reference on any of these documents or anything that the government say, safe and effective. Just quiz them. Based upon what article? And I've challenged every doctor, give me the evidence of safe and effective in kids, in pregnant patients then, and they just run off because they know they haven't got that data. Just ask them next time you see.
Well, I would, Dave, but I can't. I can't really. I don't hang out with these people anymore. I imagine it's the same with you, that we were once part of these industries, which were pushing different forms of evil, and now I've seen the light, and you wonder, is it why didn't I see it before? B, are my colleagues, are they just under a spell, or are they active participants? Are they witting participants in this evil? I suppose.
We're seeing it across, like you said, journalism. You're seeing it in things like policing. So one of the things going on down in Cornwall at the moment is they've got a load of drag queens coming down to Cornwall and reading stories to children and popping the children on their knee. You know, these are grown men who are adult entertainers in kind of almost sex industry. And I'm seeing some of the interviews where people are going up and challenging it to the actual inspector of the police, saying, why? I've got evidence here that this guy in here reading the story, he's a sex offender. He's posted this on his social media. You need to arrest him now. And they're stony faced. You know, the lights are on, no one's home. They're unemotional. And I don't know what's behind that. That's why I keep saying about this is a dark spiritual battle, because you're presenting to these senior police officers, you know, surely you can see that these grown men in lingerie and twerking around the children being worshipped. Now, firstly, it doesn't come under the LGBTQ banner at all. It's adult entertainment. Why would a grown man want to read a story, for example, to a child? And the police are stood there. In fact, they're actually protecting them and escorting them in, escorting them out. I know they're there for the car. Safety, absolutely. But they're giving them a hero's welcome and VIP treatment, when actually, and the content of the stories they're reading as well. Sorry, we've gone on a bit of tangent there to drag in story hour.
I'm not suddenly ending the interview, the conversation, because I feel you've gone into territory. No, it's not. I've got other stuff to do, and you probably have too. But where can people find you? Because it sounds like you've been heavily censored.
Yeah, I've got a Getter account, so you can find me, Dr. Cartland, I think it is, on Getter, and Truth Social has come to the UK from America, so that's starting to gather a bit of traction. Again, I don't come across any trolls or bots on those two platforms. You know, people debate politely on there. You don't get suspended. So it's a free space, really, for debate and rebuttal. And it's all polite.
That's good. And have you got any websites or anything?
No websites, no. No, I'm going to, after these next few days of interviews, I'm going off radar for a bit, because it's been exhausting.
Good luck with your, you know, earning a living and all that. I wish you... I don't think you're going to have any regrets about what you've done. You've done the right thing. You've stuck to your.
Just reminded me, James. I'm going to plug my GP service then, if you don't mind. So I've got. If you Google David Cartland, Dr. David Cartland, you'll find it on Google. It's Underspar Medical Limited, and I do a telemedicine GP service for signposting, advice, etc. So it's going okay at the moment. So just want
that's
to get out
new.
Of the NHS
that's what you
matrix
should be plugging.
ASAP.
That's definitely okay.
There you go. Well, so far, Google me.
we'll put a link at the bottom of this. Although I suspect that probably you'll get all my sites shut down as well.
I was going to say, don't share Dave Cartland's name. You will get shut down. I think there's a crosshair on my back at the moment.
Well, maybe if I call you Barbara Cartland. If I call you Dame Barbara Cartland. Maybe.
Well, I tried it, you know, on Twitter. I don't know how they find out. I tried, I set up accounts as Dr. Jab, 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 and Dr. Boost, 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 Boost. And they still found me out that it was me. Somehow they know it's you from your IP
they
address.
They can tell us what real names.
Yeah, exactly. So I'll have to think of a more interesting pseudonym.
Dr. Crippen.
Dr. Shipman.
Dr. Morrow.
Dr. Shipman.
Yeah. Well, it's been really good talking to you, and I wish you all the best. And may I remind my beloved listeners, I really appreciate your support on Patreon, Subscribestar, Substack, and Locals. And I hope to see you at some of my live speaker events when I can get my act together to sort them out. They're really good. I mean, I am really good, but it's just me getting my shit together to do it. That's all. Anyway, thank you very much, Dave, again, and enjoy the Cornish sunshine.
It's going to be a warm weekend, so for my 40th.
Yeah, you better get start waxing your board, dude.
Absolutely, dude.
All right, see ya.
All right, Chase. Take care. Speak again. Bye-bye.